KUT and KUTX listeners, the stream you've connected to is going silent on April 20th. You're likely using an old bookmark, app, or link that's been around a long time. Please visit kut.org/streams. That's kut.org/streams for more information. If you're still hearing this message next time you listen, there's a form at the bottom of that page that you can fill in for help. Our websites, apps, and npr.org are updated, so you can tune in there. Thank you for listening and supporting our stations.
This is KUT
Austin.
Stop.
This is KUT Weekend for the last weekend of May 2019. Thank you for listening. I'm Nathan Bernier with KUT 90.5, the NPR station in Austin, Texas. Here's what we got for you this week. A deal at the Texas Capitol to increase school funding and lower property taxes.
We're looking at around $5 billion in property tax cut money.
How the state's death certificate delays are putting healing on hold for a grieving family.
It displaces families that are trying to have closure.
And an Austin woman who helped change the state's constitution after her dad did not pay child support.
At that point, my mother had suffered breast cancer, so I think I was doing it for my mom.
Those stories and more in this edition of KUT Weekend.
We can definitively say future generations of children in Texas will be better off because of the education reforms passed this session. The tax burden on Texas property owners will be less because of what we accomplished this session.
Texas Governor Greg Abbott speaking this week about a deal to pass the big priorities of the legislative session: property taxes, school funding, and passing the state's budget. It's coming down to the wire. The last day of the legislative session is Monday. KUT's Ben Philpott is here to tell us what these proposals are all about. Hello, Ben.
Hello, Nathan. They're all about making the voters happy.
Isn't that what politicians do for a living?
It is, although I think there have been some arguments made that maybe Republicans had grown complacent in their support around the state. And so in 2018, when you saw Democrats flip a couple of Senate seats and flip several state House seats and a couple of congressional seats, U.S. House seats, specifically in suburban areas of the state, I think that that made the Republican leadership sit up and say, okay, now we need to maybe focus on some things that we have heard from those suburban areas that maybe we haven't focused on as much as we should. School finance, of course, being one of the biggest issues.
What is the top line information regarding the result of these negotiations?
Well, the top line numbers are $4.5 billion in additional funding to pay for everything from full day pre-K for low-income students, increase the amount of money you get for transportation, and increase what's called the basic allotment that I think we've talked about before. That is the kind of baseline amount that every school district gets per student that they educate. The compromise does have some language that provides some kind of formula that is a required small raise for teachers, librarians, nurses, counselors, but it's not $5,000. And that true amount hasn't come out. The lieutenant governor, when they did the press release, said it's an average of $4,000 in a compensation package. Now, your retirement benefits are part of your compensation package. Your health insurance are part of your compensation package. So how much of that is a direct raise and how much of it is money that is going to increase state contributions to your retirement or help lower your healthcare premiums? You know, all important things, but they're not your take-home pay.
And then the property tax aspect of it. What does this do for property taxes?
The original plan was around $2.7 billion in property tax cuts. That's money that the state would spend to lower the local school property tax rate. You know, how much you pay, how many pennies you pay per $100 value of your home, business, whatever. This compromise, you know, almost doubles that. This compromise, we're looking at $5 billion, around $5 billion in property tax cut money that'll flow through, again, different formulas based on different districts and everything. But based on the original plan that the House came up with its $2.7 billion, it was about $100 tax cut for a $200,000 home in the Austin area only, because again, every single school district has a little bit of a different tax rate. So this plan with $5 billion in it, you know, you can do a
double
little,
it basically, right?
Yeah, double, back of the napkin math. Yeah. Maybe we're talking about a $200 tax cut for a $200,000 home.
Per year.
Per year. That's true. Per year. And the bill does say that there are formulas in place to increase that property tax buy down that the state's doing. They're at least at the moment kind of promising that this is something that maybe it's a $200 tax cut in year one, maybe it's $203 in year two, maybe it's $207 in year three. It just, we'll just have to see how that goes. And that doesn't take into account the value of your property going up and you're not seeing any of that anyway.
But there is another aspect to this, which has been roundly criticized by local politicians in Travis County, Austin, AISD, which would further limit their ability to raise property tax revenue per year, not the tax rate, but the amount that they collect per year, and limit that. There have been some subtle changes that I think we should tell people about. Yeah. Right now, the limit's 8%. If they go over that, people can petition to have an election. This would lower that limit down and then automatically trigger the election to approve, not re-elect the people in power, but an election on whether this increase should be permitted.
Right.
So what are the new caps, as they're sometimes referred to?
For municipalities, that's cities and counties, it's 3.5%. So dropping from 8% to 3.5%. And as you said, then if you go over it, it's an automatic election to affirm or reject that increase in year over year revenue.
School districts, though,
2.5%.
Which is less.
It is less. And, you know, and this is where I'm going to, you know, I am not at the Capitol. There are some reporters that, you know, live at the Capitol. And one of them, a really great reporter that the Texas Tribune has, Aaliyah Swaby, she's gotten a version of this agreement, like the full version.
Wow.
And has gone over it. You can see that article at texastribune.org and probably very soon at KUT.org because we share their stuff. You know, one of the things that she was reporting in that 2.5% is that if a school district has property values, and this is property values, not taxes or revenues, have property values that are growing 2.5% or more, they would have their taxes automatically decreased to keep their tax revenue growth in line. In other words, to not go over that 2.5% in revenue year over year. And the state would be required to reimburse school districts for any additional money that they are entitled to. Austin is not a fast growing district
in terms of enrollment,
but this is about fast growing values. Austin is clearly a fast growing value area.
Right.
So what this bill means for Austin and that 2.5% cap, and then the 2.5% on fast property value increases that they're talking about here, that Aaliyah Swaby was reporting on, that means that Austin will get treated very differently from districts across the state. And I don't know that people know exactly what that means yet, but it certainly could mean a continued compression or lowering of our school property taxes, while this district still kind of gets the money that it needs to. And of course, the big thing is recapture here.
Right. I was going to ask you about that because, as we've reported many times, Austin ISD is paying more than $600 million in this last year back to the state for redistribution to other school districts. $600 million is a lot of money, and that was set to go up. Now, as I understand it, that will come down significantly under this legislation, meaning the district would have millions of dollars. We don't know exactly how many yet, but millions of dollars in additional funding.
Yes.
Is that right?
This bill would cut that recapture payment. And so there aren't a lot of districts that have this.
And Austin has the most.
But Austin has the most. Yeah. This bill would cut that overall state recapture payment by about, I believe, 47%. So almost in half. But Austin, now this is again based on an earlier plan. We have not seen the spreadsheet, or I have not seen, I should say, the spreadsheet for what it specifically means for Austin. But under the House plan, which also included a lowering of recapture, Austin was not just getting its recapture cut in half. It was getting it reduced, but some districts were getting it almost eliminated because they paid so much less. than what Austin paid.
Right.
Maybe their recapture was $10 million, and now all of a sudden they don't have to pay anything. Well, Austin was $600 million. An original house plan had it down to like $450 million. So not nothing, but not, you know, not eliminated. So Austin would still have some recapture with this. But yes, you're right. So it would be collecting money that it would not be required to send back to the state.
The current AISD budget, had the one that they're working on for the next fiscal year, has a deficit of about $50 million,
right,
from which they would draw from their savings account, essentially, their fund balance.
Yep.
So that might go away. Last week, you said you would tell us what the definition of sine die is. What the heck is sine die, Ben?
I did not take Latin, but it is Latin, and it essentially means to adjourn without a day. So whenever the House or the Senate adjourns for the day, they say the House adjourns until Tuesday morning at 10:30 a.m. You have to say when we adjourn until the next time. You have to say what the next time is. So the only way to end a session where you don't really have a next time is to say you adjourn sine die without a day to return.
But we know they'll be back in 2 years at the latest, right?
Well, I didn't say it was a perfect system.
KUT's Ben Philpott, thanks so much for going through these details for us, Ben.
Thank you.
There are new rules of the road for people riding rentable dockless electric scooters. KUT's Andrew Weber has more on a vote by the Austin City Council.
The rules formally fold the scooters into the city's transportation code and regulate them in a way similar to bikes. That means riders must abide by the city's hands-free ordinance and operate a scooter in a, quote, reasonable and prudent manner, end quote. It also bans multiple riders on a single device and requires operators not to block sidewalks when they park. Robin Stallings of Bike Texas said he supports the ordinance, but said its helmet requirement for riders under 18 could be tricky to enforce.
There's better ways to get helmets on heads, but I don't really see 17-year-olds or 16-year-olds or any other age walking around with a helmet in their hand for the once or twice a week when they might take the opportunity and jump on a micromobility device.
Violation of the ordinance is a Class C misdemeanor with a fine of $20 for a first offense and $40 for any subsequent ticket. Andrew Weber, KUT News.
Some community advocates and parents in Round Rock say they're worried that the current process to collect community feedback is lacking integrity and transparency. This comes as the Round Rock Independent School District decides whether to create a police department. As KUT's Dalia Jones reports, community organizers are asking for an investigation.
The policy discussions are steps the commission has been taking toward more comprehensive rules for minors. The library system is expanding its youth programs. City libraries have come under scrutiny from community activists who say there need to be more protections. In February, a 13-year-old Black student was arrested at the George Washington Carver Library, the city's first library branch and the first historically Black library branch. Staff say they were not behind the call that led to the teen's arrest, but advocates say there needs to be policy updates that ensure a guardian or adult is contacted right away in case of an emergency. This month's Austin Public Library report says policies are being reviewed by the administration and community organizations are being factored in, but those organizations have not been specified. Dalia Jones, KUT News.
More than 100 teachers and school staff showed up to the Austin Independent School District's board meeting this week demanding raises. KUT's Claire McInerney has more about their requests.
The board has said they will be able to give teachers a 1% raise in the budget they will pass this summer. But members of Education Austin, the union for AISD employees, says they need a 10% raise. Many asked the board to consider the rapidly changing cost of living in the city and how many teachers can't afford to live in Austin. The district has also said that it is not able to give any raise to non-teaching staff like bus drivers, cafeteria workers, and administrative staff. Teresa Razo is an elementary teacher and told the board her salary doesn't cover her rent and medications.
I am a Lyft driver. I clock in 40 hours last week. Every day I have to clock in at 5 o'clock to 10 o'clock.
The board will vote on the budget at its June meeting. Claire McInerney, KUT News.
The process of laying a loved one to rest might be the most painful experience you go through in your entire life. And then layer on top of that, the bureaucracy, the paperwork that has to be filled out in several places right after the person's death. In Texas, that process is being delayed for a lot of people because, as the Texas Standards Joy Diaz reports, the state has been experiencing longer than usual processing times for the issuance of vital records, including death certificates.
Hello, hello.
Happy Valentine.
On Valentine's Day, Denson Carmen Fontenot walked into All Faith's funeral home in Austin to make arrangements for his daughter, Courtney Meeks. Meeks was a mother of two girls. She was 32, and she struggled with mental illness, addiction, and homelessness.
Can you offer Mr. Meeks a water or anything that he might need?
Her father, Fontenot, lives in Beaumont, and with all the stress of filing everything in a timely manner and going to every government agency he needed to go to, he somehow forgot to bring his daughter's Social Security card.
Oh, I have it. Oh, yeah, okay. It's right there. It's sitting on the table.
But funeral home director Gilbert Cavazzo said not to worry.
Just let me know. That's all
I've got.
But the death certificate to us probably Monday, Tuesday.
Okay, because on it.
Monday or Tuesday, we're just a few days away. But the death certificate was not ready Monday. It wasn't ready Tuesday either. In fact, this death certificate was ready about 8 weeks later, delaying Meek's cremation. The holdup is a backlog caused by a switch into a new state computer filing system this past January. Nayeli Gallegos is with All Faith's funeral home.
Because of the transition and the changes, there were parties such as doctors, local registrars, and sometimes funeral home staff. The transition into the new system definitely set back really the whole industry and the process as a whole. I mean, we were delayed immensely in terms of cremation, timing, actual filing, amendments, changes to death certificates, etc.
The Texas Department of State Health Services, which issues death certificates, would not do a taped interview, but it answered questions via email. A department spokesperson explained the main reason for the death certificate holdup is that it took longer for all 20,000 users across the state to learn how to navigate the new computer system. Another main reason for the death certificate backlog? The health department says it's grossly understaffed. In February, State Health Services Commissioner John William Hellerstedt asked Texas lawmakers for an additional $3 million to hire 25 employees.
We understand the necessity of the death certificates. And really what we would like to have as a goal is that the turnaround time is 1 day.
In the past 4 years, the state health department has not added staff. In fact, it's lost one employee over that time. Meanwhile, as the state grows, so does the demand for more birth and death certificates. Since 2015, the number of requests for these vital records has increased by more than 500,000. Funeral director Cavazos says not only do the delays slow down cremations, burials, and the transportation of remains across state lines, but also families are left on standby, unable to move forward with financial matters.
It displaces families that are trying to have closure, they're trying to take care of the estate, take care of Social Security, take care of life insurance policies. Life insurance policy will not pay until they get a death certificate. Come on in, and why don't y'all have a seat here? You can visit some more.
Denson Carmen Fontenot was finally able to get his daughter's remains in May.
Yeah, and I'll get everything ready for March safe, because we have everything secured and all.
Gilbert Cavazos went into the funeral home safe and came back with what looked like a navy blue gift bag. Inside was a box with Courtney Meek's remains.
So this one here just is that you're receiving the death certificates and your signature here. Right. And then this here is that you're receiving her cremated remains. So
right there.
Courtney Meek's family feels like now they can finally lay her to rest. But peace and closure will still have to wait. Yeah. Although Fontenot received his daughter's remains and death certificate this month, the Travis County Medical Examiner still has to determine her cause of death. Once an official cause of death is determined, the death certificate will be amended and new copies will be printed. Then, and only then, will healing begin. In Austin, I'm Joy Diaz for the Texas Standard.
In the middle of the Chihuahuan Desert, at the base of the Davis Mountains, the San Solomon Springs fill a pool at Balmoray State Park. Now, this is considered a crown jewel of West Texas. People from all over Austin and Central Texas head there to swim. It's a tourist destination. But just 5 miles down the road sits a small community that shares the name Balmoray. And for decades, this sleepy little town relied heavily on cash spent by tourists. At least it used to. Now, Balmoray is in the middle of the Permian Basin's oil boom, and the new industry is re-energizing the economy. Marfa Public Radio's Mitch Borden has that story.
Behind Joe's Bar and Grill in Balmoray, two men are standing in a corral waiting for a goat. It bolts. Lassos are thrown. The announcer calls a time and the audience cheers. Every month, the bar holds a goat roping competition in its backyard. Teams compete to see who can lasso the animals the quickest for cash. Tonight's a good night. People are laughing, there's live music, and there's a decent crowd at the bar, made up of mostly locals and oil field workers. It's a big change from how things used to be.
Balmoray has always been a tourist town, but it doesn't have enough attraction here to attract that many tourists.
Norman Roman owns Joe's Bar and Grill and has lived in Balmoray for about 50 years. He says before the oil and gas company Apache began fracking around the town, his restaurant struggled to draw in tourists visiting Balmoray's pool.
Pretty quiet. Only weekends is when people would come out here.
That's because the pool's a few miles outside of Balmoray. And other than the odd restaurant, there's not a lot that would attract people into town. To make matters worse, last year the state park closed the pool for the entire tourist season for maintenance. And recently, the park announced the pool would shut down again for repairs. That could have been devastating for Balmoray businesses if the oil industry hadn't set up operations in the area and jump-started its economy.
Well, if you take a look around, there's new homes being brought in, mobile homes. You see more new cars. You see people out spending more money. So there's a huge difference.
Roman says people used to fight over the few jobs that were offered around town. But now, there are plenty of well-paying jobs in the oil field. Pat Brialva remembers when Balmoray was a healthy farming community. And then it was transformed into a place where people just scraped by.
All my friends had to leave and find their life somewhere else.
Brialva's on the Balmoray City Council and is a lifelong resident. Agriculture was the town's main economic driver until the 60s, when farms began to drop off. Once that happened, Balmoray saw its population of about 1,000 fall to around half that over the next few decades. Then,
it was just idle cotton fields. I mean, there was nothing. It was dead. And then this oil discovery has energized the whole area.
Once the Permian Basin's oil boom reached south to Balmoray in 2016, the community turned a corner. It went from a town that relied on infrequent tourists to being filled to the brim with oil field workers and their RVs. And the workers aren't just taking up space. They're spending money all around town, on food, beer, and at the new laundromat, all of which is majorly boosting the local economy. A decade ago, the city of Balmoray collected about $27,000 in sales tax a year. In the last 5 months, it's collected more than double that.
There's even a RV spot by the post office. You can go to the local burger joint and while ordering at the window, you can also get the phone number for more RV spaces. They're everywhere.
In general, there are just more people around Balmoray. There's even a slight traffic jam when the workers return from the oil fields at the end of the day. Not something you would have seen a couple of years ago. And changing a place's character is something the industry is known for, at least according to longtime resident James Garlick.
The oil fields, notorious for that, anywhere, whether it's in Alaska or wherever.
While wearing a cowboy hat and a large belt buckle, Garlick shows off his farm. There's a few young cows, a donkey, a garden, and a small RV park, which used to be a corral.
We have some of these guys that are welders. Some of them are operators. But they're all good people.
He tore out his roping arena to build this RV park, which can hold up to 14 trailers and charges around $500 a week from each tenant. The money is good for a retired school teacher, but Garlick admits he misses practicing roping in his backyard.
I love to ride my horses. And my son, he's a roper too. But this thing here makes more money than my roping does. I promise you that.
Balmoraine may be bringing in more cash than the small towns used to right now, but that may not last forever. Even if drilling in the area slows down, though, many residents believe the current boost from the oil industry will have lasting positive effects on the town's future. In Balmoraine, I'm Mitch Borden.
As the Texas legislative session winds down, there is always going to be disappointment. Only so many bills can get passed. Those that do get passed, not everyone's going to like them. So we're going to hear the story now of a law that took decades to come to be, and the Austin woman who was the catalyst for it. KUT's Matt Largy has that.
Susan Morrison was 2 years old when her dad left.
I knew that he existed because we would get Christmas cards signed Daddy, but we didn't know where he was.
Susan was in San Angelo with her mom, Eleanor, and her brother and sister. Susan was the youngest.
Well, I think there was a longing for him, and we would write letters and send him to an address he was supposed to be living, but we would not get any response to our letters.
Her mom worked hard to keep things together. She had a job at the Air Force Base in San Angelo.
And she was the only college-educated person in that office. And yet she was paid a little bit above minimum wage.
So it was financially, it was tough for you guys.
She lived paycheck to paycheck.
It wasn't until Susan was about 10 that she found out her dad wasn't paying child support. When she asked her mom if she could go to a summer camp.
My mom never said anything derogatory about my father. She didn't want us to have any negative feelings about him. So when she had to say that we couldn't afford it, you know, we asked why. And so she thought at that point we were old enough to know.
Did you blame him at all? Were you angry about it?
Well, maybe. I think I was mostly confused because I thought, we have laws in America. Why are the laws not making him pay?
Now, see, here's a funny thing about Texas. At this point, around 1970, all but a few states allowed court-ordered child support to be taken directly out of someone's paycheck. But not Texas.
Because our state was settled by a lot of debtors that were fleeing from creditors. They wanted to make sure that under no circumstances would anybody's paycheck ever be garnished or money taken out involuntarily.
So they put a ban on any kind of wage garnishing in the state constitution. It's not like no one ever tried to change it. Various lawmakers had tried for years to pass a constitutional amendment to allow garnishing wages for child support, but they all failed. Susan went to college in the late 70s. By that time, non-payment of child support was a huge problem in Texas. 70% of parents who were supposed to pay child support were not.
So when did your interest in the child support law start?
That started with my job at the Capitol. I was working for the Speaker of the House doing the postings for committee meetings.
This was in 1979. She saw there was a hearing for a bill on child support enforcement. She knew what she had to do.
So I went to that hearing on that bill, and I decided to just stand up and testify and tell my story, my family's story.
What did you say when you got up there for the first time?
That my mother was a single mom raising three kids on her own, and that my father was retired military, but he wasn't paying child support, and that it was harmful to families. At that point, my mother had suffered breast cancer, So I think I was doing it for my mom.
Do you remember what the reaction was when you told your story?
Everybody was interested in the room, but it still didn't pass. And so at that point, I said to myself, if it takes my whole life, I'm going to make sure this is done.
Susan headed back to college at UT the next semester. She was taking a class called Legislative Process.
And our job was to pick some legislation that we wanted to see through with our own class voting on it.
She knew exactly which bill to pick, a constitutional amendment to allow garnishing wages for child support.
I was surprised that my professor didn't really want me to focus on that bill because she said it had never passed in her class.
Just like the real legislature, the child support bill never went anywhere. But Susan kept going.
And what I did was build coalitions with like-minded people, and I supported their legislation if it was good, and they supported mine.
Her strategy worked. She rounded up enough votes, and the class passed her bill.
I think that gave me courage to go ahead and work on getting it passed for real.
Susan knew the bill had failed every time it was brought up since 1961. She knew she needed help. She had a friend who worked for Ray Farabee. He was an influential state senator from Wichita Falls. In 1983, Farabee agreed to sponsor the constitutional amendment.
Originally, it was seen as something liberal because it was taking the freedom away from an earner's control over their paycheck. The way Senator Farabee got the more conservative senators on board was to show how fiscally responsible it was.
Basically, Farabee argued that many families were on welfare because one parent wasn't paying child support. Then there was the outside support.
I think by the time the 80s came around, there were enough women in labor unions that were dues-paying members, and probably either they owed child support or they were owed child support, that they were in favor of it, so there wasn't the big push against it this time.
Opposition essentially vanished. Approval in the legislature was nearly unanimous.
Passage, Secretary, read the caption.
House Joint Resolution 1, amending the Constitution to allow for the assignment of income.
Questions on final passage. Secretary, call the roll.
Blake.
It was just really the time, I think. It was finally time for it.
Being 27 ayes and 3 noes, House Joint Resolution 1 is finally passed.
Like all state constitutional amendments, it had to be approved by voters. And it was, by a huge margin, in November 1983. Susan called her mom the next day to tell her the news.
Do you remember what you said to her or what she said to you?
She was just so proud. And relieved.
I think.
That it was going to help so many women.
Did you tell her that she was the inspiration for you doing this?
Oh, she knew.
Yeah.
Yeah. We both were very happy. And she lived 3 more months.
While all this was going on, something else was happening, too.
When my dad heard it was going to happen, he got back in touch with us. And it was only the third time we had seen him in my life. And he showed up and said, I want to pay at least some of the money I owe your mom.
The kids weren't kids anymore, but he offered to pay half of what he owed. About $30,000. Susan's mom said yes, the money would be helpful while she was fighting cancer.
It started a relationship where he would come and visit, and he invited us to come visit him.
Her dad, Herbert, lived in New Mexico. His second wife had died. He never had more kids, and he'd recently had a heart attack. Susan guesses he saw his time to get to know his kids was getting short.
Was he supportive of what you were doing with the child support law?
We never really talked about it, other than him saying, I want to pay, will she take half?
So he was obviously aware of it, but you never talked about it.
Right.
He'd write letters. Susan and her siblings would go to reunions with their dad's family, but there was a distance. In 1991, Herbert was diagnosed with prostate cancer. It moved into his bones. He had 6 months to live. He had a big request for Susan. Move to New Mexico to take care of him. She told him she couldn't give up that much.
But I am willing to rent a house, build a ramp, so that when it comes time that you aren't able to walk with a cane, that you can get in and out.
So he moved to Austin, living in the same house with Susan for the first time since she was 2 years old.
It was like living with a stranger, but it was worth it because the hospice people helped me get comfortable with him.
Family and old friends came to visit. She learned about his childhood on the family farm during the Depression, about his time in the Air Force during World War II, his year as a prisoner of war in Germany. Did you sympathize with your dad after that? I mean, like, learning all the things that he went through, did that change how you felt about, you know, what he did to you and your mom?
Well, I don't really think it excused him, but I think the deprivation made him feel like it just wasn't enough to be a family man. He told me when he was living with me that my dad said, "You know, I always loved you." It's like, no, not really. He said, if I had it to do over, I wouldn't have left my family. So there was a little bit of apology there. But he always had the power to return. For whatever reasons, he didn't.
Susan cared for Herbert for about 7 months before he was too sick to be at home. She was out of town the weekend he died.
My uncle was with him. He said he took him for pie, and he ate his pie and I guess had a heart attack and passed away. So they called me immediately, you know, rushed back to town and sort of said goodbye to him. I think it was his sort of military formalities at the funeral that was the real closure that I felt. Not so much him being gone physically as that experience of the soldiers coming and giving my brother the flag, that was the finality of it.
In the end, Susan says she's forgiven her dad. She's at peace with his absence.
I guess looking back, at the age of 61, I try to live my life being grateful because if there had been anything that ever happened to my mother, I don't know what would have happened to us because he wasn't available. We were so lucky that even though she got cancer, she survived 10 years and she kept working. One reason I went to law school was to take care of her. I didn't get to do much of that. And I know she would have been glad that I took care of my dad. Because that's how she raised us.
When it comes to child support and what Susan did to help change the law about enforcement, she knows the system isn't perfect. There are still lots of kids in Texas who aren't getting the financial support they deserve from one of their parents. But Susan hopes it's helping at least some kids have a more secure childhood than she did.
There's nothing better than a child feeling like both parents care. So that's what I'm hoping that child support enforcement across the state does, is communicate that to the kids.
Matt Largy, KUT News.
That's KUT Weekend for the last weekend of May 2019. You can subscribe to this podcast at weekend.kut.org. You can email any questions or comments to weekend@kut.org, or you can just ask me on Twitter. I'm @KUTNathan. Our theme music is by RAC. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Nathan Bernier with KUT 90.5 and KUT.org. And then,